Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope on Cyprus. Pope Benedict looks back at his pastoral visit to Cyprus last week and urged Christians there and throughout the Middle East to overcome their divisions and to persevere in their witness to the gospel in those lands. Priestly testimony. As 3 days of ceremonies begin here in the Vatican to mark the closing of the year of the priest, we hear from two Irish priests on how they discovered and are living out their vocation. And Congo's ongoing terror. As the DR Congo's human rights record comes under fresh international scrutiny, we find out more about the systematic sexual violence being meted out against women by rebel groups in the conflict zone. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked back at his pastoral visit to Cyprus last week and urged Christians there and throughout the Middle East to overcome their divisions and to persevere in their witness to the gospel in those lands. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Sporting a bright red, wide-brimmed hat, familiarly known in Rome as a cappello romano, Pope Benedict XVI was shaded from the sizzling morning sun as he weaved his way around the throngs of pilgrims and visitors to St. Peter's Square, cheerfully waving to them from the back of his Popemobile. Many of those present in the sweltering heat this Wednesday for the Pope's audience were wearing clerical collars, just some of the 9,700 accredited priests who have answered the Holy Father's call to come celebrate the close of the year for priests with him this Friday. But on Wednesday, the Pope's thoughts were still drawn towards the East and the Christian communities of the Holy Land as he retraced the steps of his recent voyage to Cyprus.
Dear brothers and sisters, in my apostolic journey to Cyprus this past week, I walked in the footsteps of Saints Paul and Barnabas, who first brought the gospel to that island, and visited the small but lively Catholic communities of the island.
In comments in Italian, the Pope revealed that his visit was successful because it had achieved its three main goals: strengthen the faith of Catholic communities in the region, encourage them to pursue the path towards full unity among Christians, especially with our Orthodox brethren, and embrace all peoples in the Middle East and bless them in the name of the Lord, asking God for the gift of peace.
In my celebrations with the Maronite and Latin Catholic communities, I witnessed their strong faith and traditions, and the vitality of the educational and charitable institutions. In Cyprus and throughout the Middle East, Christians are called to overcome divisions and to persevere in their witness to the gospel in those lands.
But the clear highlight of the trip, confided the Pope, was the delivery of the Synod Instrumentum Laboris at Mass in Nicosia on Sunday, where, he recalled, we prayed for the soul of the late Bishop Luigi Padovese, whose sudden and tragic death has left us saddened and dismayed. Pope Benedict XVI concluded his audience reflections by looking forward to the October Synod for the Middle East, which he said will be accompanied by the prayerful affection of the entire Church, in whose heart the Middle East occupies a special place. The Pope augured that the gathering will also draw the attention of other global protagonists, especially among those in public life, that they may ceaselessly work so the region can overcome situations of conflict and suffering that still afflict it, and finally find peace injustice. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Around 9,000 priests from some 90 countries are in Rome to attend 3 days of liturgical celebrations, prayers and reflections, marking the closing of the year of the priesthood, proclaimed by the Pope last June. The theme for this priestly year has been Faithfulness of Christ, Faithfulness of Priests, and his proclamation coincided with the 150th anniversary of the death of St. John Vianney, the Curé of Ars. One of the highlights of the closing ceremonies will be a prayer vigil with Pope Benedict in St. Peter's Square on Thursday evening, attended by priests, seminarians and Catholic lay people from all over the world. The gathering will include not just prayers, but testimonies from priests, music and an address by the Pope. The Year of the Priest will officially close on Friday the 11th, the Solemnity of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and the World Day for the Sanctification of the Priesthood, with a morning mass in St. Peter's Square, concelebrated by the Pope with a number of cardinals and bishops. The 3 days of ceremonies began on Wednesday with a meditation on the theme of conversion and mission in Rome's Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls, followed by a mass. Owing to the large number of priests and seminarians in Rome for these ceremonies, around half the participants gathered in another Roman basilica, St. John's Lateran, and were linked by video conference to the events taking place in St. Paul's outside the walls. But what do priests themselves say about this special year of the priest and their own priestly vocation and mission? Monsignor Paul Tai comes from Ireland and is Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. He began by delving back into his past and telling me how he first realised that he was being drawn towards the priesthood.
You are a priest forever, born again.
I would imagine that really, if I'm to say the serious kind of reflection and realisation that I felt I had a vocation to the priesthood was probably aged about 16. I remember particularly the time of my first communion when our then teacher, Mother Immaculata, informed us all that after we had received our first communion that we would hear a voice and the voice would tell us what God wanted us to do in life. I have to confess I didn't hear any voice, but I was a little embarrassed by this, particularly when subsequently the day after in class, Mother Immaculata went around to class asking everybody what the voice had asked for them. And one after another, my companions in the class were either going to be priests or nuns, etc., etc. And then it came to me and I felt I couldn't let the side down. And I said something like, I heard the voice calling to be a missionary. Obviously embarrassed that there had been no voice, but I thought, anyway, more seriously, I would say aged about 16, I had been thinking what to do in terms of university and studies and that. One of the areas I had given a lot of thought to was the area of medicine. Medicine mainly because I believed it was a way in which I could help people. There was that kind of altruistic focus in what I wanted to do with my life. And then at that stage, one of my family was quite ill and he got a lot of good, helpful medical support. But strangely, when it came to rebuilding his life, it was the help of a priest chaplain who gave him a lot of strength from faith and a sense of conviction and confidence in himself that was also quite important in his recovery. I remember I became interested in that because my own faith had always been very important to me, is still very important to me. It's a source of strength, comfort, help, challenge at times, but it's always been very alive to me. And I always felt sorry for people who didn't have that sense of the closeness of God. So in one sense, my idea was to become a priest in order to help people to know God, know his closeness, and know that he was close with them. And that, I suppose, is what brought me into the seminary.
How old were you then?
I went to the seminary aged 17, which at the time would have been even for them would have been considered quite young. I know it was a bit of a shock for my parents.
I wanted to ask you, in fact, what was the reaction from your family to this decision to become a priest?
Well, I suppose the first time I really seriously articulated this choice to explore becoming a priest was in conversation with my parents, as they had begun when I was 16, asking me what I was going to do or what I was going to study. And they had always very much insisted that I should have complete freedom to do anything I wanted. And they were them and are people of faith, but not overly demonstrative in their faith and not overly pious. And they had always wanted to assure me that I could do anything I wanted. And I think they were a bit surprised that having offered me this great freedom, I would take in what might have been seen as more a conservative or conventional choice to enter a seminary. I think they were not particularly convinced that it would work out. I remember the day I was leaving to join the seminary, they gave me the key of the house and saying, now, you're always welcome back. Don't feel you have to go ahead with this. It's your choice. But, you know, so I suppose the early years in the seminary was a sense of going to see and discern and work out if this was for me. And I had a certain freedom in that because in the early years in the seminary, I studied at the State University in Ireland. I studied civil law. My parents kind of were happy. They felt I had a bankable skill that if things didn't turn out and I left the seminary, I had something that would at least assure me some form of employment. And I suppose those years were very much years of discernment for me. I was in a class of people of my own age, guys and girls, all of my own age. There was all the standard growing up together happening. I suppose it raised the question of celibacy for me very strongly.
Was that something that you had some doubts on? I mean, was that one of the most difficult issues to come to terms with?
That was obviously the thing that one had to really come to terms with in terms of, I for myself had formulated in two ways. One was, could I live this healthily? Would it be possible to live a healthy life as a celibate? And then the second one was more followed from that was, well, if I believe I could live it in a healthy manner, do I want to? And over those years, I came to, as I knew myself and grew in a kind of awareness of myself, I became aware that this could be a very healthy choice if it was something that was chosen freely and if something you lived with generosity and with attention and with care and with prayer and support. And I became convinced that it was something that could be lived with healthiness. And then I became aware also that it was something that I wanted to choose because I felt that the Lord was asking me to become a priest. I had had a number of times when I doubted that, had considered leaving the seminary, but never found peace in that decision. And always said, no, I'll give it another try. And gradually then a certainty, this is actually what the Lord is calling me to. So I remember particularly the time of my diaconate, when I made the commitment to celibacy, in a sense made my commitment definitively to be a priest, even though the ordination came a year later, there was a huge peace. That was the main thing, a sense of peace that this decision was made. And now it was about making sure I lived it well and healthily, but the theory of whether to make it or not was already made. And with that came a certain peace, as I say.
When it came to your actual ordination, any particular emotions or memories from that day?
No, in some ways I found the day of my diaconate, when it was the day I made my own formal commitment, in some ways was a more personally significant moment. The day of my ordination was the community recognition of that. It was a great family and community occasion and I enjoyed it. But it was more peaceful for me because I'd already made my definitive decision. Obviously, the day itself was a special day, yeah.
You are the messenger.
What special rewards and gifts has being a priest brought to your life, brought to you as a person?
Well, I must say, I found being a priest has allowed me in various ways to touch the lives of different people and of different communities. You're always a priest and you never know when a friend or an acquaintance or somebody you don't know particularly well suddenly wants to talk to you about things of God, or about a difficulty or a problem they have. And they see in your closeness to the Lord a kind of strength that they want to turn to. And I suppose that's been the privilege of people looking to you for something that isn't going to come from you, but is going to come through you, which is very much the strength and support of the Lord. And I found that's been a great, to be that vessel or instrument of God's grace for other people is an extraordinary experience, to be so close to people, maybe in difficult moments and in good moments. It's at a human level, it's a very rewarding experience. I suppose the other thing that I'd have to say that comes with the whole choice, I think, is there's a freedom. Freedom that comes from celibacy. One doesn't have the perfectly wonderful commitments that a married person would have, but that gives you a certain freedom and you're more open to various possibilities. Also then the fact that financially you don't have the type of commitments that other people have also leaves you with a great freedom. And I suppose that would have been my experience over the last 27 years, is the freedom to respond to different challenges that I would never have anticipated, different types of work, be that an academic work in the early years, some pastoral engagement, then a more administrative work, and then finally, out of the blue, a call to come to Rome. But having the freedom to be able to respond to such things very quickly has been one of the gifts of the priesthood for me.
Now, you touched there on the issue of challenges. What have been some of the greatest challenges and difficulties of being a priest, especially in today's very secularized world?
I suppose one of the things is coming with it is, as a priest, you're very much representing not just yourself, but you're representing, obviously in the best possible way, representing Christ and God, but also representing the church and institution. So you become an institutional figure, at least in the eyes of other people. And that's a challenge because at times they have prejudices and ideas over who you are or what you are. And I think it's important at times to challenge them back, not to deny that one is a person of the church, not to deny one's own fundamental commitment to Christ, but to help them to understand what that means, because very often they're working with categories that are not particularly helpful. I think I've enjoyed that. I'm happy to represent the church. I'm very happy to represent Christ and his teaching. And I enjoy sometimes the challenge of taking on the person who maybe is quite angry or a bit annoyed or a bit dismissive or challenges you. I think it actually allows you to engage somebody maybe at a much more serious level once you get through that initial kind of difficulty.
Okay, right. Still staying on this same theme, of course, particularly you coming from Ireland, these past months have been difficult ones for the church because of the media spotlight on the clerical sex abuse crisis. And of course, Ireland has been very much in the forefront of that. How has this media glare affected you and your fellow priests? Has it sometimes made you feel on the defensive? Has it upset you?
I suppose in some ways it may be easy for me. I'm away from the actual reality. I don't have to face a community on a regular basis. But I know that very often at a time like this, communities want to offer a very strong support to their priest, to the priest that they know, to the priest who has been close to them in so many ways. So you get this extraordinary support for the individual priest. And yet you also then have maybe the difficulty at the more general social level that as people try to make sense of the things that went wrong, their sense of anger, their sense of disappointment at times, and you're caught in the middle, as the priest is caught in the middle. One thing that always comes to me is that in a strange way, we're now dealing with revelations that in the majority, for the greater part, go back to things that were realities 25 and more years ago. So in a strange way, the church may actually be a better place now than it was 25 years ago.
More purified in a way.
Yeah, 25 years ago, we may have thought everything was great. Nobody was challenging the church. But at the times, we know now that terrible, evil and tragic things were happening within our communities and they were not being properly managed. I think nowadays, everybody's aware of these limitations. So the facade is not so glorious, but maybe the reality of where we have a healthier church, a more honest church, and where we have better structures in place is actually a better position to be. And that, I think, that strangely was something that was, that insight was given to me, not through any reflection of my own, but I remember in prayer coming up to Christmas and how would you face a community in Ireland in the light of the very difficult times we were living, to some extent realise that maybe 30 years ago things were worse, except we weren't aware of it, and that maybe now there was a liberation that comes in admitting and facing the truth and trying to ensure that we learn from that what has been revealed to us and build a healthier community, which will also be a church that is a more credible witness to Christ's love to all people.
This year of the priest coincided with the 150th anniversary of the death of St. John Vianney, the Curé of Ars, who is set to be proclaimed the patron saint of all priests by Pope Benedict this week. Has this saint or priest been a role model for you in any way in your life?
I suppose my first ever awareness of the Curé of Ars was when I entered the seminary in Dublin and there was this particularly lifelike statue which was often used for various little jokes to frighten people by hiding it in corners of rooms and you get a fright thinking there was a figure. But at a serious level, I suppose, as we began to study and learn a little bit about the Curé of Ars, he became in many ways the model priest. And yet he's not one of the most brilliant. He wasn't one of the greatest preachers. He wasn't one of the most effective global figures. He worked in a very small area. He worked very consistently and very well, doing the ordinary things with extraordinary attentiveness. And I suppose maybe that's the reminder to all of us as priests that at times we might be a little frustrated, feel, well, if only I had a better parish or if only I had more skills or if I had more resources. But what he says is he's saying, be the priest you can be. Be that priest here and now. Don't be looking to the future. Don't be imagining some ideal situation. Give of yourself and allow the Lord's grace to transform the situation you're in. I suppose there's a genius in that, that they choose somebody whose own weakness and fragility at times made him aware of his need for God. And I suppose as priests, that's the thing we always have to remember. It's not about us. It's about the Lord. It's about Christ that we try to bring to others, be that in our preaching or in through our living at the sacraments.
That was Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications.
Also hailing from Ireland is Father Sean McDonagh, a renowned environmentalist and priest who has published several books on religion and ecology. He spoke to me about how he lives out his vocation as a priest.
I entered the seminary in 1962. It was the beginning of the Vatican Council, so I was very interested, particularly in mission, more than actually priesthood at the time. But when I was studying for the priesthood, the writings of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin became available, and I became very fascinated. Here was somebody who had a positive message for the world. And I think it's wonderful that the second last encyclical, which was written by Pope John Paul II on the Eucharist, the Ecclesia, he talks the very notions that Teilhard talked about, which is Mass on the world, and that priesthood is involved, as it is very much in the Greek Orthodox Church. All of us now are priests of creation. So every time you celebrate Mass, you actually lift up all of creation in its wonder, in its beauty, in its service to us, but also now in its brokenness. And of course, it was as a missionary I encountered the environmental movement. I didn't study the environment. I was working with a tribal group of people in the Philippines. I saw the impact of the destruction of the forests on their lives, on the environment itself, and began to learn something about it and began to think of it in terms of our Christian faith and what Christians were called to do in the face of that local environmental problem. Now, that led me on then to not just local environmental problems, but global ones as well, looking at them from the perspective of our Christian faith. And I always say, I think John's Gospel, John 10:10, captures the heart of that faith in terms of the well-being of the planet and the well-being of people. It's, I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. You can't have life to the full on a planet that has been shorn of its wonder and beauty, that's been polluted by oil spills, that has been roasted by climate change. So I think there's a very real call for priests around the world. And you see, we deal as priests in the sacramental world. In baptism, we bring people into the church. Baptism is water, and waters are endangered in many parts of the world. They've been polluted. Do we make the connection between, for example, the water we use in baptism, and is it, for example, water that is clean, or is it water that's sometimes toxic?
What, in your view, are the greatest challenges of being a priest in today's world, especially in this multicultural, multi-religious world we live in?
I suppose the greatest challenge is to make sense of the Gospel of Jesus in a multi-faith world and make sense in terms of what Pope John the 23rd called the signs of the times. What are the signs of the times? What are things that are clear right across the world at the moment? And what has the Christian faith to say to that? And how do you empower Christians to be in response to that? And I would say environmental issues are huge. The whole area of the poverty of so many people in the world, again, are huge. The impact of structures of society that are actually impoverishing people and destroying the planet. All of those are elements, but I think it's very important that the priesthood today is underpinned by a theology that engages the world. That's fundamentally what we are. And Christ came to give his life for the life of the world. And I think sometimes we can begin to think that stepping back into the sacristy and just dealing with the sort of sacred things around the altar is the way to be priests in the modern world. And I would totally oppose that. In actual fact, the Eucharist is about, it's a cosmic event, and I think we must begin to try and live that out in our daily lives and make that kind of connections for the faithful so that they would be empowered to respond to these issues.
I was speaking to Father Sean McDonagh, priest and environmental campaigner. The DR Congo says it will not allow international bodies to participate in an investigation into the death of a leading human rights activist there. The activist was found dead in his car near the capital Kinshasa earlier this week. The government says the head of police has been suspended following the death, along with several other police officers. The incident comes as the DR Congo prepares to celebrate 50 years of independence from Belgian colonial rule. The nation is still suffering from the effects of a 1998 to 2003 war that killed millions of people, and campaigners have long criticised the country's record on human rights. Despite a peace deal to end the war, people in the east of the Congo remain in terror of marauding militia and the army. Human rights campaigners say the most frequent targets of this ongoing but little publicised conflict are women. Hundreds of thousands of them have been raped, most of them gang-raped. And the UN says the sexual violence in Congo is the worst in the world. Pascal Palmer works for the Catholic Aid and Development Agency, CAFOD, and has just returned from a visit to the DR Congo, where she came face to face with many of the victims of this ongoing brutal violence against women. She spoke about what she saw and heard during her visit and what CAFOD is doing to try to help these victims.
What the situation is in the eastern provinces of DRC is the continuation of a systematic method of breaking up communities, which is as real as the machete and gun violence that was going on in Congo during the two Congo wars after the Rwandan genocide. And what I saw, I went to two main hubs in those areas, in North Kivu, the capital city Goma, and in South Kivu, Bukavu. And in both places, I met up with, in total, about 40 women who were part of CAFOD's project called The Listening Room, where women who have been sexually attacked can actually come and gain medical and then counselling to try and heal them after these terrible, terrible attacks. And I actually found during my time there that I didn't realise the scale of it. I went out into some of the parishes, just in the foothills of where the Inter-Harambwe or the FDLR still have many camps. And in a place called Mwanda, I went to meet with 15 women at a listening room. But what I found was with these women who were so incredibly brave to actually tell me their stories, every single one of them had the most horrendous tale to tell. And these were stories not from the war. These were stories for now. These were stories where people had been released, having been held by rebel troops, maybe for a month, maybe for a year. There was one woman I met who'd been held for 3 years. And every single case told of the most horrendous physical violence and sexual violence.
Palmer told us more about the shocking case of one particular woman who was seized by the rebels and was not only raped daily, but was also forced to eat human flesh by her captors.
If I can talk about one woman who I met, 55 years old, so a good age, and she'd been held by the Inter-Harambwe out in a forest. She'd been made to walk there for 3 days. She had no idea where she was. And she was held for 3 years, daily raped, and seeing different groups of hostages taken to the camp, brought to the camp, and seeing them tortured, mutilated, and on one occasion, two members of a group of hostages were beheaded. And this poor woman, having been in the camp already for a year and a half, was actually forced to eat parts of the bodies of these dead hostages. And every single woman who I spoke to had a story that had elements of that sort of horror. And what I gained from my week spent with women who have suffered sexual violence in Goma and a week spent in Bukavu is that this is such a real, devastating, ongoing war. And it's a social crisis for the population in the eastern area of DRC. Because what actually happens when these women are so brutally attacked is it doesn't stop there, it being so traditionally patriarchal. These women are seen to actually carry the blame of the attack. And what happens is that often the community and their own family will reject them, and especially they are rejected by their husbands.
That was Pascal Palmer of the Catholic Aid and Development Agency, CAFOD. Well, that's all we have time for today. I'm Susie Hodges, and from all of us here at Vatican Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to us. And don't forget, you can check out our website by going to www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.